You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Hi, y'all. It's Amir Yesai with the Take On for the Broadway Podcast Network. I'm here with D'Lo, my good friend, such an amazing activist in the community, such a really a person that a lot of people look up to in the community, specifically trans people as well, just to see that, you know, South Asian representation. It's so important. Thank you for being here with us, D'Lo.
Thank you for having me, Amir.
Of course. And what are your pronouns? I think it's important that we ask those questions these days.
I go by he or they.
Perfect. I love that. I think that I get a lot of messages from, you know, straight cisgender people who are like, what's the deal with the pronouns? And what's the big, you know, hoopla about it? And I think what I've realized is it makes people feel safe and secure when you're having a conversation. So I think it's important we take the time to make those distinctions.
Absolutely.
Right. And I think that what I love about you is that, much like me, neither of us ask for permission. We do kind of what we want and we take up space. And, you know, for both of our communities, you know, South Asian community, the Persian community, that's not a very normal way of operating. So I want you to paint us a picture of kind of how you got to the D'Lo we see today, right? Someone who is comfortable in their own skin. That's not an easy journey.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, I'm a child of immigrants and an immigrant family that was like, you know, we don't make waves in this family. Like, we're just trying to get by. We're just trying to, like, make our careers happen, and then that's it. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, I knew that I was super queer, and I was politicized as at a young age because, you know, my family came to the States pre-war by way of my father being part of America's brain drain. And my father is a doctor. Mm-hmm. And so we had that privilege going for us. But then around 83, and actually a little bit before that, my family was, you know, worried about our family in Sri Lanka because there was, you know, there was a lot of bullshit happening. So, so as the war in Sri Lanka started, you know, getting worse, I was hearing about all these stories. Plus, in addition to that, I was hearing about my father talking about neo-Nazis or the KKK. I grew up in Lancaster, California, and historically, one of the Snapple fun facts is that it was where the KKK established its first West Coast church back in the day. So, you know, we kind of just felt the effects of being in a predominantly hick white town, you know? Mm-hmm. So by the time that I was probably like 11 years old, I was introduced to hip hop. And because it was, you know, my understanding of like, first of all, the art in general, hip hop to me was like so powerful for me because people were talking about the issues that mattered to them. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to be that. And I especially loved like Public Enemy, Queen Latifah, like a bunch, but I also loved like a lot of hip hop artists. But I think it was Queen who really made me feel less alone in this world because watching her, I was like, she's an immigrant. I'm an immigrant. Like, I didn't get it. Like, I didn't know that she was not an immigrant and that Black MCs were going back to their roots. I just was like, this is who I'm attracted to, not sexually, but this is who I'm like, yo, I could be this person. Even if I can't get my wishes to be a boy, I could be this person, you know? Mm-hmm. So that I feel was kind of like the marker for my politicization and therefore the marker for my desire to create art in the world that mattered. And that could change how people were kind of mindlessly not looking out for one another, you know, like I wanted to change how we treated people, you know? So then I started writing poems and rhyme right after that. And I was like a really bad writer at this stage. But then I was writing throughout high school. And so by the time I got to college, me and this one other kid started the UCLA poetry read back up again. And while we did that, I was introduced to other artists. And then I eventually found some mentors who were associated with the Communist Party, the Revolutionary Communist Party. And so I was doing arts and organizing, political organizing through this network of artists called the Artist Network. And some of our first campaigns were around police brutality. So that's kind of, and because the work was all being done in LA, I got to meet other artists. I was part of salons where we got to talk to each other about art making and art processes and politics. And so that kind of was like the foundation for my work. And while I wasn't like really out about my queerness, like I was out, I was definitely out, but like I wasn't talking about it in my artwork. I think that things got so bad between my family and I once I came out that I couldn't help but find solace in writing work that was related to my journey as a queer person. So, and by that time I had moved to New York and I was doing theater and I had some really great teachers there as well that that I started making a career out of me telling my story, not just written poems that were about larger issues like war and police brutality and AIDS, and you get what I'm saying? Like it was almost like I could talk about my life and where I was in my queer journey and also my passions as a political artist.
Absolutely. And I think even saying that political artist, I think it's something that in some ways was really invented a long time ago. And I think now with the BLM movement and Pride being kind of front and center, a lot of people are using that verbiage, but I think that's been around for a very long time. And I love that, you know, I want to know where from political artists and activists did that kind of develop into this one-man show, which is where I met you. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting front row. I was like a kid in a candy store watching you perform. I mean, it was so wonderful.
Thank you. So my work has always been about like, if I share my journey and if I'm very specific and detailed in how I craft a story, as mm-hmm. I've been doing solo work for almost 20 years now, right? So but my aim is to be able to sort of unpack the ways that our, you know, like we're not okay as human beings unless we are really trying to connect with community and be there for one another, right? And there's so much loneliness when it comes to queerness mm-hmm. because those places of community that are supposed to hold us, aka our blood family, are so toxic and dysfunctional that our understanding of family then becomes who we have in our circles of chosen family, right? So I want all my shows to sort of share the journey of a queer person through navigating adulthood, what it means to be having healthy and beautiful masculinity as a trans masculine person, what it means to be an ally, what it means to be somebody who sees themselves as part of a continuum of a movement, you know, not just like a queer person who's saying like, I get to fuck whoever the fuck I want to fuck. And like, that's the politic. Like, yes, that is also political, right? But sure. There's also a way to show up in the world as a queer person and kind of check our privileges at any given moment and work with those privileges to fight for other people who don't have those privileges, and also understand where we would rather be or the spaces in our own life that we do want to experience more freedom and fight for that liberation as well.
Absolutely. And I think it's really having agency over what you're doing with your life. And I always tell people that are queer, like, you get to design your life. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that's kind of what you've done, especially with the show. And again, we don't get a lot of trans masculine visibility. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, Lone Star 911 has done a great job with a, you know, black trans masculine man.
That's Brian Michael Smith. Yeah.
Yes, Brian Michael Smith. Wonderful. I met him once and we had a really great conversation. And it's such great visibility, absolutely. And that's something that we need. I want to talk to you a little bit about, I know that when you did your one man show, it kept kind of, you know, selling out. And then, you know, Lily Tomlin was in the audience. How did that feel as, again, like a Sri Lankan, you know, queer child? Like, is that where you imagined your life? Because that must be like a real pinch me moment.
Yeah, it was surreal to have Lily Tomlin in the audience and to meet her and to know that, like, she loved my work. I think that for me, like, I didn't grow up knowing much about Lily Tomlin. Like, I didn't connect the dots that she was this. By the time that I was understanding who she was in the queer community, I then had to, like, sort of toggle my memory and go, oh, okay, she was in 9 to 5 and she was in this, you know. But like, I didn't actually, like, know her work in a way that I could say that she inspired me directly. But I do know that it's her work out there that has allowed for this kind of art form to even be considered, like, that this kind of art form to be taken seriously, you know. So when it comes to solo theater work, yes, I am blessed to have a really good run. I think that I've been showing at the center for a long time now. And so people are familiar with the work that I am attached to. And so because of that, my audiences have grown through the LA, through LA crowds. Now, who we were really trying to get to come. And I'm not saying that Lily Tomlin was a loss at any, like, that was a complete win. I didn't even know, you know what I'm saying? But like, right. I would have loved to be able to perform in front of people who I had idolized and who I gained so much inspiration from, whether that was, the work of like John Leguizamo or, Whoopi Goldberg or Queen Latifah, even, my God, like, you know, there's people who, I think that because I am a person of color, it was so important for me to see other people of color, because I knew that I wasn't going to see other South Asians, that my, the closest in proximity to me were going to be other people of color, other Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. So that is sort of who I looked up to as a young artist and who I was gaining a lot of inspiration from.
Absolutely. And that makes a lot of sense, especially when it comes to that journey of like finding yourself among that. Where did you, again, like, obviously you had those role models, but who in your family was really understanding? Who did you lean on as you were kind of coming out and then furthermore wanting to transition? Who was like kind of someone you leaned on?
Yeah. I would say that I probably had a tough time with both of my parents, and I don't have any siblings. One of my siblings was in a plane crash that took her life. So it was in my immediate family, my parents and I, we couldn't really see eye to eye on any of it. But
right.
Who was gunning for my happiness the whole time was more my father, which is very odd, but that is the truth. And then, well, I guess it's not that odd. Sometimes it feels like mothers are more understanding in certain regards, but I guess when it comes to queerness, you never really know. But
you never know. My mom had a huge, very tough time, and my dad, who's very conservative, kind of took it in stride. Again, for them, it's a mixed bag of, it's a choice, and do you need to do this, and et cetera. So it can be tough. Yeah.
Exactly. I went through the very same thing. Like the Hindu version of conversion therapy. So I've, yeah, like shit was wild, but you know, I feel like I had in my corner, like my cousins who were very understanding and who would bat for me. But yeah, like I think that when it came to finally to your other part of the question about transition, I think we're all in transitions. You get what I'm saying? It's just that for some people it looks medical, but I think that for me, that was part of the thing that was going to either make or break my relationship with my parents, because already there was so much like butting of heads around around my queerness. So, absolutely. but I think that like it is the case with so many queer people, I think that community is where you sort of, you know, you mark your growth based off of how you're healing in community. And so I'm grateful for that.
Absolutely. And I think it, and what you said is really key. It's like, it's different religions, different intersections. And it's really funny because I know with Hinduism, like Vishnu and Shiva, there's a lot of trans representation in that religion and even in the community. And obviously colonialism kind of changed the game with that. Mm-hmm. Did you have anyone from your Hindu community being like, this is fine and this is accepted? Or again, were you kind of on an island about it?
Yeah, nobody was. Nobody was, but I had people who were within my same age range who accepted me for who I was. Okay. Because they liked me. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yes. You're very likable, honey. I get it.
Uh-huh. As are you, honey.
Yeah, I think it, you know, what with that, so kind of being on an island like that, what is your advice to people who are kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, in a transition? I know that a lot of times when you do come out, especially to an immigrant family, there's a lot of like, well, I hope you're not trans. I hope you're not going to dress like a drag queen. I hope you're not going to wear a wig. And people start having these kind of ultimatums. How did you, like, when, at what age did you realize? Because I know for certain people, I have a lot of friends who are trans. They realized when they were like very young, but kind of didn't know how to grapple with that concept. Do you have an early memory of like feeling just kind of like, I don't feel comfortable in this body?
Yeah, it was more about like, I just saw myself as a boy. It was never like fresh out the womb as far as I could remember. I was just like, I'm a boy, you know? And so, you know, and thankfully my parents didn't actually clock that this could be an issue farther down the line, because they let me look like a boy. Like people used to come up to my parents and be like, what a cute son you have. And they wouldn't say shit. They'd be like, okay, yeah, let's keep it moving. We need to get something from Kmart. You know what I'm saying? and so they didn't even clock that it was something that they should be concerned about. But, so that's my earliest point of understanding my gender identity, was that I just didn't feel like what they wanted me to be. And then when I realized that that was actually something wrong, me behaving and looking like a boy, then I was like, oh shit, like before anybody else sniffs me out, I have to like have a plan to like either run away or like then I have to start dressing like a girl. And I ran away and they found me. And so then that summer, I just transitioned into being a girl. And yeah, that's how it was for me. But you know, to your question about like, what do you say to people who are in some sort of transition or if they're transitioning genders, I'm kind of like, you know, coming out is already like a big deal in so many different families that I'm kind of like, you know, if I could just say one thing for people to hold on to, because like in certain cases it does get better. In some cases, like let's be real, it doesn't, you know, and then that's what you have to like sort of grapple with and say, like, do I have the energy to constantly engage with this toxicity, you know? But but the part that I wanted to talk about was, you know, as I'm older now, and I think about the same folks who gave me heat or past judgment or whatever, like the uncles and aunties, this, that, and other, like family members, whatever. It's so interesting that when you really look at their lives now, they're all struggling with their own secrets. And some of them are far, far, far more heavy than queerness could be. Do you know what I'm saying? Like queerness is not heavy. It's just like, everybody's a little gay, you know what I'm saying? But it's like,
Absolutely.
But it's like, yo, why are you holding this heavy secret? Like, it doesn't have to be like that. Like, come over and just, even if you're not queer, come and kick it with queer people and realize, like, your shit is okay. Like, you know, I think that we can all learn from people who have been living their lives on the margin, and are surviving and thriving. And I pray for the haters, because I know ultimately they're just holding on to deeper, darker secrets, and these secrets will eat them. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I tell a lot of people, it's really funny. I tell a lot of people, like, especially when it comes to secrets, it's not just being queer or just coming out. Like, there, you could have so many secrets. And I know a lot of immigrant families, if you lose your job, mm-hmm. like, people will hide that. Like, 6 months, I had lost my job and didn't tell my dad.
Yeah.
Like, for some people listening, they might be like, just tell them you lost your job. It's not like you wanted to get fired, but they don't understand that your identity gets tied to that. And, you know, I think everyone comes out. They just don't, they think that coming out is only for queer people, but, you know, it could be anything. It could be divorced in an, you know, South Asian community. That's very frowned upon.
Yep.
So it could be really anything.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I wanted to ask you, as far as, like, you know, working in Hollywood, obviously, you know, with your one-man show, such a success, and, you know, working in those spaces, obviously with the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, trans visibility and, you know, Laverne Cox is killing it. And there's just, I could list so many amazing people that really wouldn't have gotten a chance, like Trace Lissette and, you know, the shows like Transparent and Pose. There's so much trans visibility now. Do you find it, like, easier to get auditions or to get work, or is it still hard also being, like, brown and, you know, trans? Like, do you think that
is it better? You know, I don't know what it is. I feel like it's still hard for me to get auditions, you know what I'm saying? But I also don't have an agent, and which is why I've kind of been like, well, maybe I should just kind of lean into learning more about writing and like from a writer creative standpoint rather than like just acting. And you know, I've been doing theater for so long, but like, I think that sometimes when I know that there's a lot riding on an audition, because it's been like one audition after so long of not having any, that I end up placing so much immense pressure on my shoulders that I end up fucking up the audition. And it's so weird, because for somebody like me who has been acting for 20 years now, you know what I'm saying? In the theater and, you know, doing like touring and literally performing like more than I'm actually in one city for, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm on the road more than I am just living in my own place.
Wow.
That kind of, I would say that like, it feels like it's been harder for me. And I think that there's also the fact that, you know, while if we're looking at people of color, while there might be a lot of Black and Latinx issues that need to be really tackled, Black, Indigenous, and Latinx issues that need to be tackled, when you look at South Asians in Hollywood, it's sort of like a little bit of the flip, because you don't see a whole lot of South Asians. And if you do, you see them of a particular narrative. And I think that South Asian stories are like everybody's cultural stories at the intersections of like race, class, gender, sexuality, all of that. Like, they're so rich. And I still have yet to see a South Asian story that is rich, you know, and that is sort of a little bit more mainstream. So I feel like it might be because of the South Asian stuff, but it also might be because of the trans stuff. And it also might be the fact that, like, I don't have an agent right now. You know what I'm saying? Right. I have somebody who works as a manager who sends me auditions, but they don't, like, I know I have other trans actor friends, and what they tell me is that I think we're all at the same sort of level and we're all getting the same auditions, and they're not that many.
Absolutely. And, you know, with shows like Never Have I Ever and Pose, I mean, we're getting more visibility. And, you know, Family Karma that was on Bravo, mm-hmm. all, you know, Indian Americans. I think there is a tide that's happening. And I know the brown community, again, this is the cisgendered kind of straight brown community. I know a lot of those actors kind of help each other. But I just, you know, and I know that a lot of trans actors also support each mm-hmm. other. But I think what's important is that the community is great, but the industry needs to meet up. You know, the fact that you've done a one-man show that was so successful and an agent didn't scoop you up, like, I'm kind of like, if you were white, that would have definitely mm-hmm. happened. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, and those are the moments where a lot of people say that I call racism a lot, but I'm like, but that's so obvious. Yeah. Like, I don't know how you can't see it any other way. Cause I remember, like, that show was so hard for me to get a ticket to because it was so booked. Yeah. Like, it was probably the most successful show that the LGBT Center has done with someone that isn't like mm-hmm. a Lily Tomlin or, you know what I mean? Like, A-list. I mean, but that's crazy. Like, that to me is so obvious. So how do you not get discouraged? Cause I know for me, even, you know, I look at my peers who are white and cisgendered, and we kind of started at the same time, and they're like on E! News, and they are like leaps and bounds ahead of me. And I can't help but think, if we have the same talent, how come you're there and I'm here, you know?
Yeah, I think that the other part about it is, Amir, like, you're not going to be, going through these doors softly. Every time you try and go through the door softly, like, you probably get hit harder on the ass on your way out, you know? And that, and like, I think that it's great because it puts you apart from like other people. And I think that one of the things, and we had talked about this before, is that it's very hard not to get jaded and to not get sad and hurt by the sort of inequalities and whatnot. But I also think that, you know, when we align ourselves together and we sort of go, okay, you know, there's, you know, in the larger world, we do need to be centering Black voices and the liberation for Black folks. And then, absolutely. And then also, like, be in conversation with ourselves around, like, what does it mean to want to be centered in this moment? Because mm-hmm. there's, our own communities don't have enough representation. And then working with both of those sort of tasks at hand in our heart as we move forward with everything that we do. So, for instance, like, you're not going to get every single, like, you're not going to get the opportunities that a white cis gay person is going to get.
No. You absolutely.
And you might not be floating in the same circles because, you know, mm-hmm. as we all know, like, people get comfortable with their own kind. But
yes,
but what it is that when the opportunities do come knocking on your door, they are mm-hmm. specifically for you because of what you mm-hmm. have to offer. And I think that that's something Amen. That I haven't come, I talk to a lot of my artist friends about, is like, what do we need to do to be more authentic and real? Because this is a radical moment right now. It's a beautiful moment. And I mean, it's a scary moment in a lot of different ways, because a lot of people are going out their goddamn minds. But in a lot of other ways, outside of that bigotry and racism, this is also a beautiful, powerful moment for us to sort of be like, well, what are my values? And what do I pride myself in being? And like, I can't get mad at myself for being a social justice aligned artist. Like, I can't. I can't be like, oh shit, I should just like tone down or quiet down. Like, that's never gonna happen. You know what I'm saying? So like, I have to just be able to embrace that and be like, this is what I have to offer. Not that I've ever had a problem with me being a social justice aligned artist, but like, you know, sometimes right. It's like, oh, you know, understanding where it is that, what it is that you might need to do in order to get the check or the opportunity, but always staying true to your core, you know? Because that's ultimately, I think that people without knowing are craving authenticity. You know what I'm saying?
Why do people meet authentic people? They're like, oh, I like this person. It's like, well, why do you like them? They're authentic.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And they want, and not just authentic, like, I think that there's a desire for people to be nuanced and layered and complex in their politics, their understanding of the world, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's so, again, like you said, it's very nuanced, it's very intentional, and it's very also understanding that a lot of diversity we focus on is on camera and there's none off camera. Mm-hmm. And I think that those people are the gatekeepers of our stories. And I think it's taking control of your narrative. And that's what I love about what you did. And it's like, for me, it was the same. Like, you know, I was like, okay, you're not going to give me a job, that I'm going to make my own digital talk show and talk to all the people I want to talk to. And I'm going to create my space. And I think you did that, which is super inspiring, especially for a lot of people. If you look at the Mindy Kalings and the Issa Rae's and the Ava DuVernay's of the world, they weren't given those opportunities. Right. So they made them, you know, and that's super inspiring because let's be honest, it took Hollywood 300 years or like hundreds of years of racism and not even letting Hattie McDaniels into the Oscars when she won to now finally put Ava DuVernay and Whoopi Goldberg on a diversity panel just this year. So I think that the industry is slowly catching up. And I think that it's, you know, I hope that, you know, voices like yours will be, you know, illuminated and highlighted because it's much needed.
Yeah. And yours too. Yeah. That's what I want for you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I think it's important that, you know, we're heard and our stories are told according to our pens and not some white cisgendered man who got a job because his dad's a producer. Yeah. That's not who I want to tell my story, you know? And so I think that having these conversations is important. I wanted to ask you, you know, kind of on a more lighter note, how does it feel kind of, I mean, it's not very light, I guess, but it's like navigating, you know, dating in LA, like how has that experience been for you? Because I think a lot of, you know, people are so focused when it comes to trans people on their bodies and all of that. And they kind of lose sight of the fact that trans people are looking for love and relationships. And, you know, there's like even being Middle Eastern and, you know, queer, I get fetishized a lot. I know there's a lot of fetishization of, you know, trans bodies. What has been your experience with dating? Like, how have you navigated?
I feel like I got fetishized more as a gender nonconforming person who like off the stage than I do now. And it could also be in part to the fact that like my energy has shifted because I am, you know, like when I've been in my relationship with my partner for 10 years and it just changes the way that you relate to other people. Like I'm just kind of, you know, of course there are beautiful people everywhere, but like my energy is going to be different towards everybody. You know what I'm saying? And because I'm in a monogamous relationship. I feel like trans people are fetishized and especially trans women, you know, trans feminine folks. Mm. But in regards to my dating, like I feel like I ended up accidentally and also with my own fair share of curiosity, sort of dating people who were far more curious about me and also thought like, oh, this was their experiment. You know what I'm saying? And so that has been, you know, something I think that a lot of queer people of color have to deal with that, whether that's around ethnicity or whether that's around your gender presentation or whatever. Right. But,
absolutely.
But And I wish that there was a way that somebody could create an app where you could just be like, look, I'm just looking for love. I'm looking for, whether that's with one person or more than one person, I'm just looking for a beautiful sort of commitment to be in with someone or someone's. And there's not that. And I know in my opinion, I feel like it's worse with gay men. You know what I'm saying? Like the amount of racism and like internalized homophobia and all of that, like, and the fetishization, like, I just feel like it's so toxic in some that I'm kind of like, whenever I feel like I have all my gay male friends who talk to me about their partnerships, they're just like some of them had been together from even before the apps, and they're just like, thank God, you know? And then, and then the ones who have found each other outside of the apps now are like, I can't believe I found somebody during this time. You know, like I just feel like it's so shitty. I've been on my homies' Tinders and Grindrs, and I'm like, oh yeah. Like, I mean, like if people are trying to fuck, like, I get it. Like, fuck, like, do what you need to do. You know what I'm saying? But like,
but don't make people feel bad to do that. Like, I think it's a matter of like, if you never want to sleep with a black man or a Persian man or someone that's hairy, that's fine. But don't write no black, no Asian. I don't have to see it. And I've had these conversations, you know, I've been called the sand N-word, which is like a Middle Eastern slur, which is, it's like, I've been called terrorist, or people have said, oh, you know, can you tell, like, you know, when we're having sex, can you role play and call me, like, you know, whatever, like, say you're going to bomb me up or something. I mean, I just heard it all. And I think that the reason I talk about it is because most white cisgendered gay friends or people that I've known are like, no, that doesn't happen. I'm like, because it doesn't happen to you doesn't mean it doesn't happen to other people. And I think that's why it's important to illuminate. And I know that, and you know, Grindr understands that. They're doing their work. They're like trying, but you know, you can't control. Unfortunately, as we know right now, even with the pandemic, there's a lot of assholes. There's a lot of people that don't wear masks. There's a lot of people that are saying, you know, our lives matter in Texas. I mean, it's just a crapshoot right now. So we just have to be authentic to what speaks to us. And for me, it was to no longer go to gay bars, is no longer to be on Grindr, is no longer to date. That's where I'm happy. And if someone comes along who's fabulous, I'm open to it. But I'm not actively going to look for a relationship because I'm whether or not I'm too sensitive, that doesn't matter. That's where I'm at. You know, and I think there's an idea with gay men specifically where we have to have sex at all times to survive. And that's just not everyone's, you know, experience. So I think it's, you know, important to have these conversations and to move forward. I wanted to ask you about moments like, you know, being an activist and being a trans person. I've experienced this too. Do you ever get burnout about talking about it, about discussing it, about answering questions?
Yes, absolutely. But I think that there's potential for burnout on any sort of tip. Like, even if you're like the type of person who is out there in the streets marching, you're going to get burnt out. Even if it's like you have to talk to every single person about like this latest thing. I am an advocate for snacks and naps because, you know, I a lot of my mentors burned out. And they didn't know how to take care of themselves. They were suffering from some sort of physical illness at some point. So, or still are. And so I think that what I've been doing is kind of learning in a backwards way based off of what my mentors didn't tell me, but what I saw, and trying to advocate for both my own, the collective that I work with, the artist collective that I work with, and just other folks who I'm in community with, to just kind of like go, okay, at one point, does it just feel exhausting to exist? Like, you want to catch it before that? Like, if you catch it after that, like, that's fine. Like, if that's where you're starting, like catch yourself right when you're feeling exhausted and you can't do no more, and be like, okay, everything's going to be on hold, and the world can wait, and I'm going to go and take a couple days of rest and relaxation, to rejuvenate and to recalibrate, really, right? And to take that mm-hmm. time to think. But I think that what the point is for us to do is to like kind of catch it beforehand or build in to our weeks, like moments of rest. Like for this month, I know that I will not get to rest that much because I am on like 100 deadlines this month. But I do know that I can go, okay, you know what? On Sunday, I'm going to cancel everything and I'm just going to relax. You know what I'm saying? And even if I do get a little, even if I do have to do a little bit of work because I'm behind or whatever, at least I know that I didn't schedule anything else.
Absolutely. Well, it's being conscious of what your needs are. And I remember I went to a panel that Patrice Cullors, who started Black Lives Matter. And she said, sometimes I'm marching and sometimes I'm getting my hair done and listening to mm-hmm. Mariah Carey. So I think it's having that balance. I think there's this idea in the U.S. especially where we have to run and work and hustle until we just die at our desks. And I don't like really like that perspective. Living. I think the quarantine has slowed everyone down to an amazing pace. And I, you know, just to wrap up, I wanted to ask you, how has quarantine affected your creativity? Like, have you been writing or creating? Like, how is this time?
That's a great question. In the beginning of the pandemic, honestly, I was just trying not to lose my mind. then at some point, the collective that I was working with, that I still work with, I have a collective of queer South Asian artists who I've been working with. And I told you about them, right, Amir? And so we've been continuing working, and we were working on a lot of more political work. And then at some point with the quarantine, we started hosting a space for people to just kind of come into the Zoom room and talk about what art they wanted to continue doing and create and et cetera, et cetera. And then with everything with Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd and that other, that lady in the park with the dog against the Cooper, the brother with the last name Cooper, and all of that shit happened. And then we created the space that was like, okay, we are going to host a South Asian artist for Black Lives. And so that has kept going, and it's going beautifully. And we are trying to figure out ways to create, not ways to create, but what art we can create that addresses anti-Black racism in our communities. So that's kind of been what's happening there. Then I got this on the slash career or community slash career side. I got awarded an Artist Disruptor Fellowship through the Center for Cultural Power and Joey Soloway's 50/50 by 2020 initiative. And so that is a lot of that's like what my July deadlines are about. In addition to, I have two other deadlines for other gigs that I signed on to from before. So it feels like I'm working a lot, and like I'm thankful for the fact that I'm getting, this is paid work. You know what I'm saying?
We love paid work.
But right now, as I'm talking to you, I'm like, you know, this, the pace at which I was going prior, which felt a little bit more manageable, is not the pace that I'm working at right now. Like, I feel like I'm almost back to going full steam ahead. And I think that that is problematic. You know what I'm saying? So I'm almost grateful for the fact that we're quarantining, because otherwise I probably, you know, like, I think that all of us were getting caught up with our busyness, thinking that productivity was paramount. You get what I'm saying? And
the idea is like, if we don't work, someone else, i.e. a white person, is going to take our opportunity.
Like, I mean, but it's always that, right? And it's sort of like, but when do we actually prioritize ourselves? When do we actually prioritize? Like, it doesn't matter if somebody gets this opportunity. No matter how much I work, by the time I get an opportunity, I'm just going to be broken and jaded that I won't be even able to do my job well. Do you get what I'm saying? And we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. We are light, beautiful motherfuckers. Like, we don't need to be doing that shit to ourselves. You get what I'm saying? So
Totally.
I mean, I've taken jobs where I should have been happy about it, but I was so fucking stressed that I couldn't even think about the joy around it. I just celebrated it when it came out. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, that's not the way I want to fucking live.
Mm-mm. It's not the right way to live. And I think for the cheap seats in the back, I want to repeat it. When you get an opportunity, you can't even do your job because you're so jaded and upset. We want these opportunities and we work ourselves into the ground and, you know, D'Lo's so right. And then once you get it, you can't even do your job right, nor can you even enjoy the success because you're so wrapped up in your
BS.
Or
like the work is supposed to be joyful too. Like I know that, you know, you're like, you probably, and because I do this too, it's like, okay, well, I want to do something because I want to stay working because at least this gives me some anchor and grounding and like that I'm just doing what I can personally do during this moment. But then it's sort of like, if opportunities come that like at some point in my career, I forgot that if somebody asked me to come do a job for them, that I would have to erase who I was because I needed to do this job in a particular way. And the truth of the matter is every job that especially you and I get called to do, they are asking for us to come to the room fully ourselves, right? So and even if they thought they knew and they're not okay with it, that's almost like what our ancestors are asking us to do, is just to come into the room fully ourselves. And what that means to me personally is coming into that room with a fuck ton of joy. Not even the enjoyment of having gotten the job, but just a fuck ton of joy doing a damn job or doing something. You get what I'm saying? Like just to be able to do what we do shouldn't be so burdensome. And I think that sometimes when you're chasing paper, it inevitably looks like it's just a grind. And we wouldn't have gotten into this field if we weren't trying to have like live in our joy. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And I think living in that joy is what will propel us to the next level. I think that, and I think it's remembering that and remembering why, like you said, our ancestors did what they did and, you know, why Marsha P. Johnson, you know, and Sylvia Rivera went to Stonewall and, you know, went against police brutality. Like there's a reason they did all that for us and we shouldn't be like, again, kind of chained to our jobs and chained to our identities as the only worth we have. You know, I've even stopped kind of saying I'm a queer Muslim over and over again because I feel like white producers love to bastardize that word and they salivate at the torture porn that is my life. And I just, it's like, I want to talk about positivity because our identities are important to us, but D'Lo is more than just their identity. And Amir is more than just his identity. So I think it's reimagining that, which is super powerful. I could talk to you all day, as you know, but I will let you go. But please tell us how people can follow you and kind of stay in touch with you for your journey.
My handle for literally everything is DLocoKid. That's DLocoKid. And that's my website, Instagram, YouTube, this, that, and other. It's everything. So yes, I loved being on the show with you, Amir. I love talking to you in general too. So it was always going to be a win-win situation. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I feel the same way. I really do. I think it's, you know, the way you take up space is so, it's like so effortless, but I know with everything, like even ballet, it looks effortless, but I know how much work goes into being very effortlessly yourself. So I applaud you.
Thank you. Right back at you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here for the Take On for the Broadway Podcast Network. I'm Amir Yasai, and you can follow me at Amir Yas Official on Instagram and TikTok and on Twitter. It's Amir Yas _. I love you all and be good to yourselves. I know it's a trying time, but we'll be here every week, every Tuesday, dropping a new episode for the Take On. Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Take On. The Take On is produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals, edited by Kyle Moore, and is a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. You can find out more about me and The Take On at bpn.fm/The Take On, and of course on my Instagram at Amir Yas Official. Yes, honey, we're official. Make sure to subscribe and rate The Take On wherever you stream your podcast, and keep tuning in for more amazing guests.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.